What, if anything, can we do about mass shootings? And were the police derelict in Uvalde, Texas? Plus, is it okay to joke about trans issues? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Philip Phil Klein, and Madeline Maddie Kearns. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Allegiance Gold, Ball & Branch Sheets, and Masterworks. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So before we begin in earnest, let me say a few words about Allegiance Gold, the official gold IRA of the Editor's podcast. Inflation rates are a growing concern for Americans with retirement accounts. Understandably, Allegiance Gold can help you protect your IRA 401k with physical gold and silver. They'll also give you $500 of free silver with a qualified purchase. Call 844-790-9191. 844-790-9191 or visit allegiancegold.com/editors, allegiancegold.com/editors. Please check it out. So Maddie, another horrible day in America, another mass shooting at a school. In this case, shades of Sandy Hook. The shooter shoots his grandmother in the face. She survives, runs off to call the police or get help. And he drives like a bat out of hell towards this school. He crashes into a ditch. We're just learning now he fired at a couple of bystanders across the street at a funeral home. And then is kind of stalking around like a maniac. Which he was, climbs the fence, gets into an unlocked door, and then this hideous carnage ensues. General impressions of this incident?
Well, beyond the obvious of it just being absolutely horrific, and depressingly, we've come to expect this now as a fact of modern life in America. The shooter, of course, fits a profile. He's a loner. He was bullied as a child, spent a lot of time online, very alienated, was really spending a lot of time in essentially a virtual reality. He came from family dysfunction. It's just a story of nihilism and alienation. And I think, you know, Ronald Reagan pointed out that really it's only deep moral values and strong social institutions that can hold back these sort of darker impulses of human nature. And unfortunately, we've just seen the methods of this collapse with the breakdown in family, breakdown in community. And obviously there's a discussion to be had about what could have been done. Things seem very clear in hindsight, but actually there's, you know, it's very difficult to predict who is going to, what troubled teenagers are going to turn into these school shooters. Of course, at least I think around 50% of them do leak their plans in advance. And I think there was indication that he had done so to a stranger on social media. And of course, there was minutes of time in which people could have acted between him shooting his grandmother and arriving at the school, which I'm sure we'll get into. But generally, a very sad day in America. And the partisanship in the fallout is just depressing beyond words.
So the importance of community in your mind is that it would make harder for these marginalized young males to be quite as asocialized as they are now.
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, it's all of the shooters that I can think of have been male, and we've seen the devastating effects of not having male role models, not having a father figure seems to be the common denominator here. And with the alienation that happens now, with people spending more and more time online and can be sort of radicalized, whether that's radicalized as happens in the UK with this demographic in radical Islamic ideology. In this case, it can be a sort of just deep anti-human nihilism, basically a sort of narcissistic nihilism. And I think that really you've got to bring back religion. You've got to bring back the family. Those are the greatest guardrails that we have against this kind of dysfunction.
So we're going to get into some of the policy proposals around this in the next segment, but let's just focus on this incident and Phil, particularly the response to it. Last 36 hours or so, there's been a real focus on how the police reacted. And kind of for me, sort of the first tell was the vagueness around the an officer at the school supposedly engaging the shooter prior to his entry into the school or immediately upon his entry into the school. At first, those shots were fired. And you're like, okay, this officer did his very best to keep this guy out of the school and was just powered. Became, well, shots weren't fired. And then it became, well, actually, there was no officer there whatsoever. And, you know, just like Parkland, you began to get the sick feeling in your stomach that actually this was a massive security failure. It turns out he didn't come in through, you know, the front door. He came through a door that was locked, that was unlocked in the back. So there are two elements, at least, of failure here. One is, we were talking right before we started to record, he shoots his grandmother, which is, you know, engenders a 911 call. Then he drives to the school. Apparently, the timeline, he crashes at 11:28. He begins shooting at these bystanders at 11:30. Someone calls 911, no cop. He enters the school at 11:40. Then the police get there at 11:44. So that just seems like, in a small town, that seems like a long time. I know in my experience, when I occasionally witness stuff in the streets and call the cop for help, it does take a long time. You know, it takes a long time in New York City, but you wonder if there's a report of a gunman outside of school, why does it take 14 minutes for a cop to get there? And then the question of how this perpetrator was allowed to not confronted, not door wasn't barged, broken down, and cops pouring into the classroom, you know, for an hour. He was in there an hour. We've seen the videos now of parents distressed, being held back by the cops, being in some cases tased or briefly handcuffed by the cops. There's a story of a man or a woman who heard about the shooting, was 40 miles away, drove to the school. Up, the cops are standing outside, begins to realize what's going on, implores them, go inside, or saying, you know, I want to go inside and get my kids. They preventing this parent from doing it. The parent finds a way around the cops, runs into school, gets his or her two kids out, and the incident was still going on. So the doctor now is, you're supposed to, if there's an active shooter, doesn't matter if there's one cop, doesn't matter if there's 10 cops, you immediately engage that shooter. You do everything you can to stop the carnage as soon as you can. And here it appears they're calling for all sorts of backup. They're calling for body armor, reports say. They're calling for tactical teams. They're calling for negotiators. And even if the shooter, you know, horrifically did most of his carnage, committed most of this carnage in the initial minutes, there were still children bleeding in that classroom.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's worth just saying as a general caveat that we're still learning a lot more about it. Perhaps there are, you know, legitimate answers to all the various questions that have been raised in the last couple of days. But with that, because, you know, early reports, as we know, in these situations are often wrong, and the situations in sort of these sort of crisis scenarios, a lot of times there's reasonable explanations for things. That having been said, one of the reasons that we've been getting a lot of conflicting information is that local law enforcement has not been forthcoming, and that has been distributing contradictory information to the public. And there are a lot of legitimate questions that need to be answered. This wasn't exactly an inconspicuous shooter, right? So he shoots his grandmother in the face, steals her car, drives it into a ditch, and then starts shooting across the street. And so I think that you could argue that once he enters the building, there's not much that can be done to prevent carnage because of the fact that if you're somebody who has a gun shooting at unarmed students and teachers, it won't take you more than a few minutes to kill a lot of people. So the real opportunity was in that gap between the time when the police were called and the time when they got there. And then the fact that he would shoot at them in the hallway, apparently before he entered the classroom, and instead of having more police officers enter and continue to pursue him, they decided to retreat and set up a perimeter. That perimeter might make sense if it's some sort of hostage standoff situation. But evidently all that happened was the shooter went in and just started killing everyone he could in the actual classroom, my understanding based on the latest reports is that all of the deaths were in that classroom that he barricaded himself into.
And he showed no, I mean, apparently they were trying to engage in negotiations with him, and he just didn't respond whatsoever.
Yeah. So to me, once you have a shooter who's, you already know, has been shooting up, and he's going into a school with AR-15s, based on everything we've known about mass shootings and school shooters over the recent decades, you just have to take him out, because you have to assume he's going to go in there to try to deliver as much carnage as possible and then either kill himself or get shot by cops, right? So it's quite inexplicable. And we really have to have better explanation for what happened, both for accountability reasons, but also because, as Charlie pointed out this week, even though sort of any one of these horrific events is one too many, relatively speaking, the odds of a school shooting happening, of a kid dying in a school shooting is something like one in a million. And we have hundreds of thousands of schools, and every couple of years we have one of these horrific shootings. In terms of this sort of scale of shootings. So there isn't essentially a lot that we have to go on in terms of how to prevent these events where there are various unique characteristics. But I think that if you look at, I mean, certainly at Parkland, there was a police failure. And if you look at here, there's certainly questions about the police response, and I think more transparency may help local police departments tailor better strategies in cases like this in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously just terrible to have an initial erroneous account of events out there. I mean, and these are public officials and spokesmen for police departments. You know, they're not on Twitter. They don't have to speculate and. Send bad info instantly out there. If they don't know, they should just say they don't know. But Charlie, what do you make of the police response and the controversy around it?
Well, it's been quite difficult to follow what happened in the response, because the story keeps changing. And I think there are two possibilities as to why that is, neither of them good. The first possibility, the one I would instinctively move towards, is that the police are incompetent and shambolic, and that their post-mortem has been as ineffective as was their response. The second option is that they're lying or altering details post hoc to make themselves look better. I suppose a third option is that we're seeing a combination of the two. Certainly, it seems as if some of the initial arguments here, that this school had thought long and hard about how to deal with this situation and then executed its plan to no effect, are wrong. the school may have considered the possibility of this happening, but I don't think at this point anyone could say that this is how schools should respond. We have to rethink, certainly, the town of Uvalde must rethink, but I suspect a lot of other school districts too have to rethink and retrain for this moment, because this is something that's going to happen again. I think that it is pretty difficult for any school district or really any venue to plan properly for this sort of attack, mm-hmm. precisely because this sort of attack is so rare. I don't mean when I say that that the level of death that attacks such as these yield is acceptable. And I don't mean to pretend that this isn't a problem that is more acute in the United States, in part because we have so many guns, than in, say, Britain. I do mean, though, that compared to everyday crime and suicide, it is almost impossible to pinpoint when and where and how this is going to happen. Phil referenced some of my writing on this. The number of children who are killed in attacks on schools is about 7 a year. That includes staff since 1999. For reference, that is about 1/15th of the number of children who die every year on school transportation. And that makes it really, really tough to anticipate. That said, whatever rules are in place, whatever guidelines are in place, whatever emergency protocols are in place, clearly failed spectacularly here once again, as they did down in Parkland in Florida in 2018. I have read over and over again from government and in the press that after Columbine, police and first responders were instructed how to deal with this, and they now know. I don't think that's true. And whatever else we decide to do as a country, we need to go back to the drawing board, because the scenes that we are seeing in videos and reported in the press of the not only the initial response, but also the subsequent response of parents begging to go in, of cops standing around, of authorities arresting bystanders who are trying to help, we can't have that as our modus operandi.
So Maddie Kearns asks a question on this segment. Do you have any hope of this horrific trend we've really seen since Columbine of mass shootings, especially at schools, diminishing over the next several years? Yes or no?
I would like to say yes, but unfortunately, no.
Phil Klein?
No.
Shelley Cook?
No. I don't think these sort of extremely rare but extremely devastating spectacular mass shooting events are going to go away. I do think we can do more to prevent crime and suicide, which is the lion's share of this problem, but is paradoxically much less likely to grab attention and emotion.
I'll make it a depressing, unanimous no. So with that, Charlie, let's go to you for the read about Ball and Branch sheets.
The Ball and Branch sheets on which I sleep, although I won't be this evening because I am actually for Memorial Day down further south in Florida. And when I get back home, I will jump straight back into Charlie, my Ball and Branch sheet.
You should travel with your Ball and Branch sheets. Show us
your commitment. I actually know somebody who travels with his sheets and sends them ahead to hotel rooms. I do. Anyway, I don't know whether they're Boll & Branch sheets, but they should be, because Boll & Branch uses the best 100% organic cotton threads on earth for a superior softness and better night's sleep. Their sheets aren't just buttery, breathable, and impossibly soft to start, but they get better with every single wash. Boll & Branch sheets aren't just about the thread count. Forget the thread count. Boll & Branch gives you thread quality because it doesn't matter how many threads your sheets have if they aren't the best threads possible. And I know this because when I'm not down here, I sleep on Boll & Branch sheets every single night. They do feel nice to lie on. It's funny to say or imagine that you can tell the difference between sheets. They seem such a standard part of any house, like a coffee cup, but actually Boll & Branch sheets do feel different, and they lead to a better night's sleep, which is great because you end up spending a good deal of your life asleep, sadly enough. I have the signature hemmed sheets from Boll & Branch, which are a bestseller for a reason. The sheets are made with threads so luxurious, they're beloved by three US presidents. I don't know which ones. I do know I can't join them constitutionally. They feel buttery to the touch. They're super breathable. They're perfect for every season, or in Florida, the perpetual summer. They have 10,000 stellar reviews. They come in 9 neutral colors in all sizes, from twin up to California King. And if you get some, you will immediately feel the difference. And they're 100% free from toxins, which means no pesticides, formaldehyde, or other harsh chemicals. They fit the deepest of mattresses, and they're labeled with top and bottom tags, so making your bed is easier than ever. And best of all, Boll & Branch will give you a 30-night risk-free trial with free shipping and returns on all orders. So if you don't like them, which you will, I doubt they get many returns, you can send them back. And as an Editor's listener, you'll get 15% off your first set of sheets when you use promo code EDITORS15 at bollandbranch.com. That's B-O-L-L-A-N-D branch.com. And the promo code is EDITORS15.
Thanks, Charlie. So let me stick with you. You hit on this in the prior segment, but what is your answer to this question? We've heard a lot of people on the left saying this. Ted Cruz was confronted with a British TV interviewer, maybe from Sky News or something, saying, why in America, why across the rest of the advanced world, you do not have the scourge of mass killings and mass shootings in schools? What is wrong with your country, with our country, that this happens here and nowhere else?
Well, that's a $1 million question. And despite what President Biden implied at his press conference on Tuesday, it is not the case that we all know the answer, but that only some of us wish to share it. And that this is therefore a fight between people who care about what happened and people who don't care about what happened. This is extremely complicated. And I think increasingly people are saying that they don't know what to do. I did the New York Times' podcast, The Argument, yesterday, and the man I was arguing with said as well, he doesn't know what to do. I think, though, there are a few things that we can try. Clearly, the mass availability of firearms in the United States makes a difference. But that isn't to say that we can pretend that we don't have the mass availability of firearms in the United States. In a sense, it's a dull and meaningless statement. Japan doesn't have many guns. America has 400 million, maybe more, guns in private hands. As a result, there will be more crimes committed with guns in America than Japan. But those guns are here. They were also here in huge numbers in 1950, but it didn't happen a great deal. So there's clearly a copycat element. There's clearly a sociological element too. And we shouldn't shy away from looking at those. But on the what we can do front, I am not one of those people who has mocked the idea of hardening schools where possible. It will not be the answer, but I think it could help. Having multiple emergency exits, but a single monitored entry point, is what an awful lot of institutions that wish to stay secure already do. Courthouses work like that. All of the attractions at Disney World and Disney World itself works like that. movie theaters work like that, and a good number of private schools work like that. Not because they think they can completely stop this if they do, but because it does make it more difficult. I think this is largely a question for the states, but if the federal government really wants to get involved, then perhaps it could use some of the $130 billion that is currently sitting in the states for COVID relief that is not being used. 93% of that money hasn't been spent. Use a small portion of it, and you could improve a lot of public schools. Some would probably need rebuilding from scratch. That's a non-starter. But replacing doors and security protocols is possible. Second, I am open to the idea of a well-crafted red flag system that has staunch due process protections built in. I am skeptical as a civil libertarian, but we do have systems in the United States where governments are allowed to act and then are put on the clock. That, for example, is how the arrest system works. The government is allowed to arrest you, but it has to demonstrate some cause afterwards pretty quickly. The government is, in some states, allowed to commit you if you're deemed to be a danger to yourself, but has to show some cause pretty soon afterwards. And I'm not sure that it is impossible to create a narrowly based and safely circumvented red flag law that would help in certain circumstances, again, not all. And finally, you know, one of my objections to the gun control movement is that they invariably respond to atrocities such as this by invoking laws that have nothing to do with it. We saw this after Sandy Hook. The Toomey Mansion bill had absolutely nothing to do with what had happened, and yet it was sold as a fix or a panacea or at least as an improvement. It wasn't. We have seen this here. Chuck Schumer introduced into the Senate two bills, one to expand federal background checks to private transfers. I think it's unconstitutional. The other to expand the number of days the federal government can prevent someone from buying a gun if they come up blank within the background check process to 10 that have nothing to do with what happened. Well, we have seen a number of mass shootings recently in which 18-year-olds have bought rifles. 18-year-olds can't buy handguns under federal law until they're 21. They also can't buy rifles in Florida until they're 21, for example. So many states have brought those age of majority rules into line. I'm not convinced that it will improve everything, and I understand that, there are objections to it, although I don't think the constitutional objections are strong. But at least preventing 18-year-olds from buying rifles addresses or tries to address the actual problem in many cases. And as was pointed out this week, this guy did actually obey the law. I mean, he clearly followed the incentives in the law. He waited until his 18th birthday to go and buy a rifle, and he passed a background check in that process. So I would be interested in looking at that. I don't think there are constitutional objections, and I think it does have the benefit of being directly responsive to the problem that we are trying to address.
Yeah, Maddie. So I think that the debate would be a lot healthier. This isn't going to happen, but a lot healthier if everyone just acknowledged we don't have a ready answer for this. But instead, you have everyone from Joe Biden down to celebrities saying, let's stop this now. Let's act now. It's only your cowardice that you're not acting to stop the shooting. Well, no one has that answer. Also, a lot of contempt has been poured on the idea. Charlie mentioned it. Ted Cruz has mentioned it. You know, single entry into schools. You know, that's not going to solve the problem or all these shootings. You're not going to be able to do it at all schools. And that contempt is being showered on that idea by people who are strong supporters of universal background checks as a way to address this, which, as Charlie points out, has nothing to do with any of these shootings, because every single time the shooter hasn't been committed, hasn't committed a crime, and passes a background check. Now, all that said, I do think we should be attempting to do what we can at the margins, and it's all at the margins, to make it harder for these kind of events to happen. And, you know, if a shooting happens at a school every 3 years rather than every 2 years, that's really good. And that's going to prevent a shattering event for a community and for the nation. And I think it does involve, to the extent you can, hardening the schools. I think Charlie's idea, single entry, ideally, you know, having to go through two doors and a vestibule to get into the school. And then you have multiple points of exit and a playground that is not easily accessed by any passerby. That would be great to the extent we can do that. Armed guards at schools, I think, is a good idea. Then the gun control measures, most of them don't make sense, but I think Charlie's correct. We've had a lot of these shootings now, 18, 19 year olds. Make it 21. There's not an important question of principle here. You can't buy a handgun until you're 21. The exception for a rifle made sense 40, 50 years ago when, you know, you're just buying a rifle to go hunting. That's not the case anymore. And then also I take the point from civil libertarians need to be crafted carefully, but red flag laws to me make sense. If someone, a 19-year-old, is torturing animals and talking about shooting up a school, there should be a way to stop him with judicial review, with due process, but a way to stop him from going and buying a gun. It just seems insane to me that if we're not even trying to do that.
Yeah. So I think for Democrats saying we need to do something, it's obviously a very human reaction. We all feel that on some level, but for them, it's also ideological. And I think this is an issue where you see very clearly the difference in starting position between the left and the right, because the left really does believe that policy can solve all problems if it's their policy and it's just done the way they say. They do believe in a kind of utopian world where there isn't evil, where you don't have people who would do such a thing. And the right is starting from a more pessimistic and I would argue realistic perspective, which is that it's about damage minimization as opposed to just eradicating the problem altogether. So any effective policy has obviously got to be grounded in reality. And if you actually just go through the list, I think it's a useful exercise to think, okay, which policy would have in this case made a difference, as you've referenced that this young man didn't have a criminal record, so nothing was flagged on a background check. The assault rifle ban, like, well, he could have legally obtained any other type of gun and that would have made a difference. And even with the red flag law, which I agree is probably an area where there's the most room for making at some difference, it's not clear that it would have worked in this case either. I mean, it depends on someone, a peer, family member, or social media user, if we want to maybe give more rein to big data to intervene in these types of borderline cases. But none of that would have really made a difference in this case, because none of these people did report this this person. And so, you know, even in with the Buffalo shooter, they have a red flag statute, and the shooter was referred for mental health counseling and he was still able to purchase a gun. So certainly I think focusing on that as an area of reform could make some difference. I agree. I'm actually all in favor of raising the age limit to 21. I think that's one step. That's one concrete thing that we could do. How much difference it makes, hard to say, but it's certainly the thing that infringes on the least amount of rights and can at least be a step in the right direction. But until we can have a serious conversation about the limits of policy in addressing this problem, I don't see that we're going to have effective reform or even the capacity for bipartisan reform, which is obviously ultimately what's needed.
Yeah, to your point about you know, no one reporting this kid and how the you know, what looks alarming might be a little different beforehand and afterwards, right? He apparently worked at a Wendy's and occasionally said, I'm going to come shoot up this Wendy's. And there was an employee there who was interviewed by someone and said, we just thought it was a joke, you know? Right. So that if you have red flag law in place at that time, you'd hope like, oh, the Wendy employee will immediately go to a judge or an authority. But if you think it's a joke, you know, you're not gonna do this. So again, all this stuff is at the margins, Phil.
Yeah. So I'm sort of very dark on this issue, and basically, you know, have the most unpopular view, which is that really there's nothing that you could do. I don't think that anything really, I mean, I sort of appreciate the idea that this is so horrific that we have to think of ways to stop it. And we should constantly debate every way that could potentially move the needle. Even if you could prevent one more of these than would have happened over a 10-year period, it's something that you have to consider. I just, my view is that basically there are a lot of strategies that you could do to prevent crime, but I feel like the mass shooter phenomenon is the least likely to be affected by any sort of changes. Charlie has written and spoken a lot about why the various gun measures are unlikely to make a difference. I don't think that the issues, I'm much more skeptical about the idea of the red flag laws. I'm worried whenever you give government the power to deprive people of constitutional rights who haven't committed a crime just based on the idea that, well, they seem sort of suspicious and they could be a danger. To me, if you think of the profile of a loner high school student who becomes a school shooter, there are probably hundreds or thousands or millions of people that would fit that profile of saying really weird things on social media and to their friends and seeming kind of suspicious and a bit of a loner, and I feel, who don't turn out to be mass shooters. And just sort of so willy-nilly.
Let me push you on that point, Phil. It's hypothetical. So someone's posting on social media, I'm going to go and shoot up a school. And and people seen it and they have a gnawing sense of fear about it. That kid should be able to go down and buy two AR-15s without anyone.
I think that there's sort of issues that are when there's sort of a specific threat. I believe that there are laws in place about making various specific threats that you could maybe.
So just a general, I'm gonna shoot up a school. Would that be illegal to say that?
I don't know enough about what the pre-existing laws and rules are without red flag laws, but I'm just saying that I'm sort of reticent whenever I hear the idea of that the government is going to deprive people of constitutional rights without them having committed an actual crime.
So I think
just based on suspicion.
I think Phil's skepticism here is warranted, and it's a skepticism that I share, and that in probably the majority of cases I would echo, because many of the laws that we're mooting here would be written by people who had other political agendas or whose ulterior motive was to make it more difficult for people who hadn't done anything wrong to get hold of firearms. But I think it is worth noting that there is a way of doing this that is consistent with the First Amendment and also with the Fifth and 14th Amendments. If you issue a threat that is too specific, you can be prosecuted for that alone, absent firearms or any other weapons. If I say, I think we should have a revolution, that's protected. But if I tell someone I'm going to start a revolution or I'm going to shoot up this Wendy's as part of my revolution, we start to get into Brandenburg v. Ohio territory. Now, obviously, when we get into that territory, the government still has to prosecute. And if the government is collecting information in the process of deciding whether or not to prosecute, it is allowed to arrest you. If it decides after 24 hours that you were joking, or that there's no pattern here, or that there'd been a misunderstanding, it has to let you go, and it should have to let you go. And I will stand on the ramparts until I am old and frail, shouting that the government should have to let you go. I think the argument for red flag laws is somewhat similar. That is, you create a narrow group of categories, not you thought the election was stolen in 2020, not you vote Republican, not you have views that are currently out of fashion, but that conform fairly closely to the sort of speech that is already in the grey area. And if the government has enough cause to suspect that you might be serious, it can initiate proceedings and initiate an investigation. And if it has no evidence, it has to back off. I could see a narrowly tailored law that essentially echoes the ones we already have on speech and applies it to the possession of firearms. I share all the civil libertarian concerns, but I would just note that we do already do that with other crimes. And
yes. So where do restraining orders come in here? Because I guess there's not a constitutional right to see your children, but we deny people who haven't committed crimes the ability to do it just on the presumption that they're threatening.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what I'm saying, is that I am not, for example, against the police being able to arrest people. I am against the police being able to detain people for a certain period of time. I'm for the police being able to arrest people and detain them without cause. I am against the police being able to arrest people and detain them without judicial oversight. I'm against the police being able to arrest and detain people without reference to particular laws. In other words, I'm fine with the police having the power to arrest. My issue is what happens next, and I favor extremely strict rules on that, being a civil libertarian. The same rules I would apply to restraining orders, and the same rules I would apply to a potential red flag law. And I'm willing to consider those laws if they are really tightly circumscribed. And this is the key point too. It's not just about how long or whether there's judicial oversight. If the triggering categories are narrow, as they are with, say, speech, or they should be when it comes to restraining orders, you know, such that you can't initiate a restraining order against somebody because they say they don't believe a man who says he's a woman is a woman. But you can initiate a restraining order against someone, which is then subject to all sorts of protections, if you hear someone say, tomorrow I'm going to kill my children or kidnap my children.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the issue is, and I don't mean to get caught up in red flag laws because I was leading to a different point, but I think the issue is that we could come up and craft whatever narrowly tailored thing that we have, but ultimately you have to assume that at some point this red flag law is going to be in the hands of some liberal politically motivated district attorney, right? We have right now, we had an editorial this week about how there are liberal district attorneys in otherwise red states and in blue cities vowing that they won't enforce abortion restrictions if Roe's overturned and the state imposes abortion restrictions. We've had situations where the IRS has targeted conservative groups, where just recently the DOJ and FBI was going after parents who are activists. We had a big debate in which after the Buffalo shooting, they basically conflated anyone who's talking about demographic changes in America and the implications of them with a shooter who has a crazy conspiracy theory where Jews are somehow conspiring to orchestrate this white genocide and saying everything's the same. So, I mean, to me, I think that it's very worrisome to basically give this power to the state. So that's why I'm sort of skeptical of that. But my point is that the broader point I'm making is that in this case, in the Uvalde situation, you had a teenager who shot his own grandmother in the face and then proceeded to go to elementary school and mow down 19 children, right? So to me, if somebody's so far gone that they're willing to do this, they're not really going to be stopped by a lot of these things that are considering. I think that there are a lot of, I think that some of the mockery of Ted Cruz talking about a single entrance is over the top. But at the same time, I think that we're arguing too much about securing the building, right? It's great to secure the building, but why would somebody who's willing to shoot children and shoot their own grandmother be so fixated on a building? If they can't shoot people in a building, why wouldn't they go to a soccer practice or a high school football game or to the local mall?
I mean, that's true, but there, this cultural idea has been created by Columbine, where some percentage of these malicious, evil people go to schools. And I just think, if anything else, just for the peace of mind of parents, you want to know that's not going to happen in your school. Sure, it's extremely unlikely, but it's a shattering experience. It just seems to me, Phil, the implication of your position, and maybe this is what it is as a libertarian, is like, we shouldn't have restraining orders. We shouldn't have a whole host of things because they might be abused and used against conservatives. Why wouldn't this apply to restraining orders?
I mean, I think that restraining orders, there's a much different issue because of the, in the case of guns, there is a leftist zeal to take away guns from people. And I think that doesn't happen with the case of restraining orders. And if you could basically, when Democrats are going out and talking about, you know, during the most campaign about mandatory buybacks, which is a fancy way, is a euphemism for just outright gun confiscation, right? If they're mandatory, they're not voluntary buybacks.
That's an entirely different thing. I mean, here we're talking about a family member, a counselor at a high school reporting someone and a judge reviewing it. So if the law is written such that a progressive DA can come in and start denying people guns, I would oppose that law. But if it's appropriately written and has to do with a, you know, real threat, I mean, if all of a sudden all the conservative 18-year-old males in a community are being denied the right to buy a gun, yeah. But it just seems, if you write it appropriately, there are going to be very few politicized reports of, oh, this conservative, 19-year-old is torturing animals, and it's false. He's not really torturing animals. He hasn't really cut himself. He hasn't really said he's going to blow up his school. Yeah, then I mean, that's a potential abuse, but it seems very unlikely to me.
I mean, I guess I'm just sort of much more skeptical about how government power gets instituted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's worth saying that there is a difference between underlying law and bad behavior from government. And as a rule, and I share this instinct myself, one wants to limit the number of laws so that the possibility for bad behavior is diminished. And one also wants to narrow existing laws to make abundantly clear what they cover and what they don't. But even if you do that perfectly, as you say, Phil, sometimes prosecutors or DAs will behave badly. But the fact that Merrick Garland sent that letter does not in and of itself cast any doubt or imply a criticism of the decision in Brandenburg v. Ohio, right? It doesn't cast any doubt or imply a criticism on the handful of speech laws that we have, because it didn't apply to them. I mean, the criticism of Merrick Garland is not that he has taken laws that we have passed and is abusing them. The criticism of Merrick Garland is that his behavior flew directly in the face of existing law. And my point here is, if a DA or a prosecutor can ignore existing law or can violate existing law, that's not a case against that existing law. That's a case against that prosecutor. And in a sense, you would have got that either way. I mean, you'd have got that whether you pass the law or not, because they're trying to violate it. So I don't quite see the categorical objection, unless, as Rich says, we're also going to get rid of restraining orders and arrests. I think that the The challenge here is always to make sure that the secondary part of it is safe. What happens after a government official has done something wrong, which no law or constitution can stop, but it can end.
Okay, well, we better move on. Maybe we'll pursue this in the corner in subsequent days and weeks. Maddie Kern's exit question to you: will the needle move in any respect with regard to policy? Good, bad, indifferent, whether it's security at schools, whether it's gun measures in response to this shooting or not?
I think that people will try and find areas of common ground, like the red flag law, and it will move slightly, I think.
Phil Klein.
I don't think it'll change much.
Thanks to you, Phil. Charlie Cook.
I just want to say, despite our argument, I have a great deal of time for what Phil is saying. And I instinctively share many of the fears myself. I think that Congress is going to have essentially to accept Republican terms on this. And those Republican terms seem likely to me to be that there will be no federal law here at all, but that the federal government might send money to the states and encourage them to institute new policies. So if they do that, I could see money for hardening schools and maybe money to encourage the operation of state-level red flag laws. But I think if the Democrats try to go further than that, these talks will end with nothing.
So I think the needle will move a little bit. I don't know about the federal level. I think that's unlikely, but we might see the age limit for buying rifles bumped up some places. I think we'll see states looking more at hardening schools. Nothing transformative, but the needle will move. And with that, let's hear from our other sponsor of this episode, Masterworks. Masterworks allows anyone to invest in artworks without being a millionaire. Masterworks was founded in 2017 by Scott Lynn, a serial entrepreneur and art collector. He was an art collector for years and realized art is the largest asset class that was never securitized. Over the last four decades, this asset has had almost no correlation to other asset classes. This means, as the BBC has explained, it can go up in value even when the market dips. That's because art doesn't mirror the performance of other types of investment. Deloitte expects the art and collectible market to grow by $1 trillion from $1.7 trillion to $2.7 trillion by 2026. It's a physical asset like gold and real estate, and it's unique in that there's never going to be the original same painting twice. You can't print it out of thin air like paper bills. Unlike NFTs or cryptocurrency, art is a real tangible asset, just like real estate. But unlike a house or land, you can actually transport this asset and you can sell it anywhere in the world in any currency. Plus, during times of high inflation of 3% or higher, art appreciates 23% on average. Masterworks has securitized over $500 million worth of contemporary art. It has works by the likes of Picasso, Warhol, Monet, and 400,000 members are part of Masterworks, and it is valued at $1 billion. So in short, now anyone can invest in blue chip artwork without being a millionaire. Start building a diversified art portfolio at masterworks.io/editors. Again, that's masterworks.io/editors. See important Regulation A disclosures at masterworks.io/CD. Again, please check it out, masterworks.io/editors.
So Maddie, entirely shifting gears, you wrote a piece this week about how important it is for comedians to be able to joke about trans-related issues. And we actually see comedians, Ricky Gervais, Bill Maher, of course, Dave Chappelle, who was actually almost attacked on stage from someone enraged by his trans material. We actually see them refusing to honor this taboo, and you consider that a very good thing?
I do. I think that it's dangerous when societies have sacred cows that nobody's allowed to criticize. And the role of comedy is to puncture those overinflated sacred cows. And I think that's exactly what's necessarily happening here with the trans issue. There's a lot of talk in comedy about whether or not you should punch up or whether or not you should punch down, but that's not really for anyone to decide. That's the comedians are always breaking taboos, and that's kind of the point of comedy. And I should note, I watched the whole of Ricky Gervais's Netflix special, and there was stuff in there that I found offensive. But so what? Other people might enjoy it, and I don't have to watch it. And his segment on the trans stuff was much more geared towards the ideology than any specific individual. And that's actually same with Bill Maher's monologue, and same with Dave Chappelle. It's really about these really crazy ideas that are going out there. And I think it's very welcome pushback. And actually, it's one of the only spaces in the liberal mainstream that you will see this, which is just proof that sex-based rights and reality are now officially countercultural, because the only place they get criticized by liberals is in comedy. So I think we need to see more of it, to be honest.
So Phil, speaking of Netflix, we had this extraordinary memo to Netflix staff that no, we're not going to cancel people and circumscribe our material in accordance with the ideological tastes of the moment, which seems to be part of a broader trend, perhaps dating back to the Georgia election controversy and how these companies basically got shut down and Major League Baseball was basically embarrassed by what it did, pulling the All-Star game, or perhaps to not to trigger Charlie, but to what DeSantis did with Disney, his fight there, and then the revocation, at least for now, of the independent special district that Disney has enjoyed for so long. But for whatever reason, it looks as though there might be an inflection point here.
Yeah, and I think that as a result of a lot of the pushback and market realities, businesses realize that they kind of can't afford to just cater to a very narrow enclave of viewers. For Netflix, it's a particular challenge because basically they sort of benefited from the early adopter model for the streaming service and were able to get all of this content relatively cheaply from studios who didn't have streaming platforms. But as the other studios started their own streaming platforms, Netflix has been under greater and greater advantage pressure to produce original content that people want to watch. And they benefited from a huge run-up during the pandemic when everyone was stuck at home and watching Netflix. But they just reported their first loss in subscribers in over 10 years. So essentially, they don't have the luxury to just be catering to just sort of liberal elites and have that be their business. They have to cater to the whole country. And the CEO is pretty blunt in his memo about the market realities and the fact that, sorry, but the woke staff, if they can't take it, they're going to have to leave because they have to provide content that will appeal to a wide variety of viewers. That's the model. The whole model of a subscription service is you have to provide a wide range of content so that there's something for everyone, so that it just keeps you from canceling. All they're interested in is, once they sign you up, is to keep you from canceling. So that there's stuff for kids, there's stuff that for people who like documentaries, for TV, whatever. And if you flip on Netflix and it's only catering to wokeness, people aren't going to watch it. And clearly people were tuning out. Netflix also, of anyone, probably has the most sophisticated algorithms and tools for measuring what people are watching and what they're interested in. And my guess is that they were seeing that, the Chappelle stuff and the Ricky Gervais specials and a lot of these things that were being criticized were probably getting a lot of views, potentially a lot of repeat views, and that a lot of this woke content nobody was really watching or interested in. It was just essentially wallpaper, digital wallpaper. And so and the CEO, that, I mean, they also, not only are they doing stuff like the Ricky Gervais show, but they also canceled a bunch of stuff. They were going to do a series on an adaptation of Kendi's anti-racist baby book, and that got canceled. They fired 150 employees who were heavily concentrated on working on a lot of these woke projects. So I do think it's pretty dramatic, and it's again not the only thing. We saw how State Farm sort of backed off supplying these LGBTQIA question mark books to students. Our own Caroline Downey did a lot of reporting on that. ExxonMobil, we saw that they banned Black Lives Matter flags from being used. So I think that corporations are much more cognizant of the perception that and the reality that they were just basically caving into the woke mob, and they realized that it's really a paper tiger, that it's a few hundred people on Twitter that start foaming at the mouth, and some employees that they could do without.
Jacob?
Well, I'm baffled now as ever by the self-entitlement of the trans lobby, which seems to believe that it should never be criticized or joked about. This isn't new. The Ricky Gervais special in question does not solely joke about trans people. It jokes about a whole host of issues that I'm sure some people find offensive. There's a Holocaust joke in there, joke about pedophiles, joke about midgets. There are jokes about Christians. There's a joke about AIDS. But it's the trans one that gets the headlines. I'm reminded of the fracas from 2014 over the card game Cards Against Humanity, which is deliberately extremely offensive and funny as a result. In 2014, Cards Against Humanity announced that it was removing one of its cards that said passable transvestite on it because it was offensive. But the whole point of Cards Against Humanity is to be offensive. And as a result, it left in cards that read, for example, "What will always get you laid? Date rape." Or, "In 1,000 years, when paper money is but a distant memory, black people will be our currency." I mean, Cards Against Humanity features jokes about the Holocaust, about the massacre of American Indians, about molesting altar boys, drug addiction. A lot of Holocaust jokes. I mean, there are punchlines about Auschwitz and
you really Stephen know this Hawking's game very disability. Well, Charlie.
Yeah, please go on. We should have had a segment about Cards Against Humanity.
But the point is that they left all that in. So if you played Cards Against Humanity in 2015,
you played this game, Charlie?
Well, if you played it in 2015, you would get jokes about raping kids, but not a joke about transvestites, because for some reason that's different. And I would ask the same question over Ricky Gervais and Dave Chappelle as I did when Cards Against Humanity made that decision. Why? Why? What is so special about these people that they are to be inoculated against our culture, that they're to be exempt from jokes? And it's funny, because what's actually happened is that it's hardened comedians against this sort of cultural censorship. They now make jokes they might not have bothered to make. They don't want to be told. And often they explain why they're making the joke. And why they're making the joke is that it's unhealthy for a society to cordon off particular people and their complaints and fears and hopes, and insist that they're untouchable. So I see it as extremely healthy that comedians whose job is to first off make us laugh and secondary in the process to comment on society and flip it upside down for a while, I find it extremely encouraging that they have said absolutely not. And I find it even more encouraging that the various means by which those comedians work is conveyed to the public have begun to tell the trans lobby to shove it. Whether it's out of commercial imperatives or not, Netflix has now started to say, if you don't like us conveying information that upsets you, don't work here. And this is a healthy fight back.
So segue to the next question to you, Maddie Kearns, comedy will prevail over its critics, yes or no?
Yes.
Phil Klein?
Yes.
Charlie Cook?
Yes, of course.
Yes, indeed. So let's do the Georgia primaries. We talked about this on Tuesday prior to knowing the results. Crushing, just a crushing victory for Brian Kemp. Brad Raffensperger amazingly wins and avoids a runoff. Trump's insurance commissioner choice. Yes, he had an insurance commissioner choice. Got, I think, like 15.7% of the vote against Brian Kemp's selected insurance commissioner. So exit question to you, Phil Klein, rate the blow that the Georgia primary is to Donald Trump and Monty Python's Black Knight terms. It is either a mere flesh wound or he's a bloody stump standing ineffectually across the bridge with all his limbs having been chopped off, but still issuing threats or somewhere in between.
Rich, you should moonlight as the writer of Cards Against Humanity.
I would say it's probably somewhere in between. I think that clearly this was a big embarrassment for him. This was sort of ground zero for the 2020 election conspiracy, and Raffensperger and Kemp were two of his big targets. And both of them handily got reelected over his chosen candidates. And so I think it is definitely more than a flesh wound, but at the same time, we can't view this in isolation. You know, he got his candidates elected in Ohio, likely in Pennsylvania. And so I think that this is, it's sort of too early to sort of write off Trump and say everyone is done with Trump. But I think, you know, Kemp does show a path for how people that could sort of stand up to Trump and win.
Guy Cook.
Yeah, I think he's maybe lost an arm, but ultimately Donald Trump's appeal is entirely to his own benefit. And Barack Obama didn't have much of a talent for pushing other people across the finish line either, and he still won re-election. So I think it is an indication that Trump's influence is waning somewhat, but I think it's more of an influence that people don't care about 2020. And they don't want to relitigate 2020, and they're not interested in talking about 2020. And as such, it's probably a lesson for Trump that if he wants to stay relevant and remain the front runner, then he needs to pick a new theme.
Yeah, Maddie Kearns.
I think it's kind of like a deep wound that will require stitches, but will heal very nicely and then just have a sort of faint pink looking scar, which he'll manage to make, add to his street cred or something. Just to exhaust your metaphor there.
So I think it definitely is something got chopped off. But I'm with Charlie. This is Georgia saying, you know what, we're just beyond the 2020 thing. It's been destructive. It's too long. It's time to move on. Our state is not going to be your political plaything. You know, Trump's lost Georgia three times now between 2020 against Biden and then contributing to the loss of the Senate seats in the special election. And now this, And also his endorsements, obviously, they're just not magic, as Phil says. Some of them work, some of them don't. But that doesn't mean that Trump himself is done by any stretch of the imagination. So I tend to be 70-70-50 on Trump. 70% chance he'll run for the nomination. If he runs, 70% chance he wins. If he wins the nomination, probably 50% chance. I mean, a lot of speculation built into that. 50% chance he would win the general election. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Maddie Kearns, you have been engaged in the heroic minute.
Yes. So this is basically something I picked up when I was on retreat as a piece of advice from great spiritual leaders, is that you should start the day with a virtuous conquering of your desire to hit the snooze button. And it hasn't really been going that well, to be honest with you, but I'm at least trying. So sometimes you can put your if your phone is your also your alarm, you can put that on the other side of the room so that you have to get out of bed, which makes you less likely to get back into bed theoretically. But I have noticed on the days that I have managed to do this that it does kind of set the tone for the day, and I'm more likely to be productive. And
really?
Yeah, I am actually. Yeah, it sort you sort of feel like a great sense of purpose and drive. So,
and so this was what I've been doing wrong my whole adult life.
hitting the snooze button, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
Phil Klein, you've been watching Better Call Saul.
Yeah, I kind of was a huge Breaking Bad fan. And then when Better Call Saul started, I was kind of excited about it. But by the second season, I just sort of got distracted with other stuff, and I sort of had lost interest. And for years, everyone's been telling me how great it is and how I have to watch it. And some people have even said it's better than Breaking Bad. I kind of feel like that's a heavy exaggeration, although I have been enjoying it, and I'm trying to binge it because the last episodes are going to be this summer. So I'm going to try to catch up in time for the last episodes over the summer.
Charlie Cook.
I went to my son's kindergarten graduation ceremony, in which they came on one by one to the stage, dressed as what they want to be when they grow up, and talked about it. It was extremely cute. A lot of firefighters, a lot of cops, a lot of astronauts, a lot of baseball players. But the absolute show-stealing moment was when one little girl completely broke the mold, and she came on in a very nice-fitting little pantsuit and said, "When I grow up, I want to be a property developer." Brought the house down after an endless array of basketball players and fighter pilots.
So I've been reading this book by Peter Ackroyd, a historian who wrote this wonderful series on British history. I read one of these before, Rebellion, about the English Civil War and the Glorious Revolution, that period. I'm reading the first now, Foundation, the History of England from its earliest beginnings to the Tudors. And I just maintained before there was American exceptionalism, there was English exceptionalism, a brutal time, time you would not want to have lived in or crossed a English king. But it's just amazing just how quickly barons and the community of the realm, as they said, was revolting against British kings, was attempting to rein them in, wrung Magna Carta out of King John, and then tried to get subsequent kings to abide by it. And you can see through kind of the darkness and a lot of horrific bloodletting, you can see the beginnings of the foundations of this country and its system of government. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick is the National Review Editors The Week, which comes out with every magazine and is just really, really well done every time. But I especially enjoyed it this week because I had some vacation days in the last few weeks, so I enjoyed catching up.
So you got up in your heroic minute and then you used to sip coffee and read The Week.
Yes, exactly.
Bill Klein.
I really enjoyed Jim Carrey's Morning Jolt today. We were talking a lot about the questions about Uvalde and the police response. He has a good piece today, just what happened in Uvalde, kind of breaking it down. And he's also on the scene at the NRA in Houston. And so he has some details from that where he says the sort of protests that were planned for so far have seemed to be fizzled, but we'll wait and see.
Charlie Cook.
Well, Kevin Williamson has been beating seven bells out of Saul Cornell, who is this ghastly professor at Fordham who has spent a lot of the last 20 years lying about the Second Amendment. And it turns out Saul Cornell also lies about other things, in this case, the effectiveness of various weapons. Kevin caught him in the lie, apparently got him to concede the lie privately, but has not got him to do so publicly. So Kevin wrote it up no fewer than three times on National Review. And I would recommend anyone who likes seeing Kevin in his prime read the trilogy.
So my pick is an excerpt in the new issue of the Print magazine by our friend and colleague, Douglas Murray. Western Civ has got to stay, making the case why we need to preserve Western civilization, teach Western civilization, not tear at the pillars of Western civilization. And this is an excerpt from his best-selling book, The War on the West, and is worth reading, and the book is worth picking up. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, Phil. Thanks to Allegiance Gold, Ball and Branch Sheets, and Masterworks. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. See you next time.